The last case of the day is number 073908, the United States against Clarence Grock. Garrity.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Michael Garrity. I am one of the attorneys on that represents the defendant appellant, Clarence Grock, with me as well as Mark Inman, who is also Mr. Grock's counsel. On September the 18th of 2006, Clarence Grock arrived on a plane from France via Detroit at the Indianapolis International Airport. Unfortunately for him, he was greeted by an array of Joint Task Force law enforcement officials, combined agents from the state police and the ATF. Those agents were monitoring Mr. Grock on the basis of an anonymous tip that was provided that indicated that Mr. Grock had potentially possessed child pornography and was potentially involved in child molestation. Based upon the information provided in the tip, officers were able to locate Mr. Grock's car, which was parked in short-term parking at the airport.
Is that part of the tip? The car was out there?
Judge, the record on that point is actually unclear. And it's a good question. They were able to figure out that his car was a Chevrolet, it was specifically described, and that the car had temporary Virginia tags. I'm frankly, as we sit here, unclear as to whether or not those officers knew that those tags were registered to Mr. Grock. The inference, I think the fair inference from the fact, and I think the district court's inference from the facts, was that part of the tip contained information that described the car. But I can't stand here with certainty and tell you that that material was contained within the information provided by the anonymous tip. Upon disembarking, Grock appeared to be confused. He was being followed at that time by Officer Sego, who was on Joint Task Force. Officer Sego had never heard of Clarence Grock before and was there because he had been asked to be there by ATF Special Agent Eric Jensen. Officer Sego followed Mr. Grock as he disembarked from the plane, out of the concourse, down towards the baggage area. Testimony at the suppression hearing revealed that Mr. Grock asked agents for assistance in locating the baggage area, and once he arrived, stepped outside to smoke a cigarette, waiting for his baggage to be deplaned effectively. Sometime before his baggage arrived and after he finished smoking his cigarette, Mr. Grock sparked up a conversation with a fellow passenger, and as part of that conversation, elicited the assistance of that passenger's ride, effectively. A male shows up and speaks to the female, and agents overhear Mr. Grock inquire about whether or not he, too, can have a ride from the airport. Agents overhear Grock say that, quote, any hotel will do. The agent's inference at that point, obviously, was that Mr. Grock intended to leave the airport. And after Mr. Grock obtained his baggage from baggage claim and placed it in these individuals' vehicle, at that point he was approached by law enforcement officials. He was detained. There is no legal argument that is otherwise. The court found that he was detained at that point, and the folks that were supposed to give him a ride were told to leave. Judge McKinney's ruling was that once his putative ride was instructed to leave the airport, the Fourth Amendment attached to Mr. Grock, and that this was no consensual encounter, that this was in fact a Terry stop. And as this court is well aware, this court is now subject to de novo review as to whether or not there was a requisite showing of reasonable suspicion of criminal activity to support that Terry stop. As an aside, it's an interesting factual note that, and I think I've omitted, that at some point during the 2 to 3 weeks that Grock was in France, a drug dog circled his vehicle, a drug and currency dog, and alerted on the vehicle.
Now, was that specifically targeting that car, or was it some sort of a general search?
My inference from the facts was that the dog was there to hit on, or at least sniff, that specific vehicle.
What was it sniffing for, or do you know?
My understanding was that that dog was trained to detect either drugs and or currency. It was not a bomb-sniffing dog.
It wasn't explosive.
Correct, Judge. That's my inference. That was the testimony at the suppression hearing, was that it was trained by the state police to detect drugs and or currency, but there's no reference to bombs or explosive devices. District court found that there was reasonable suspicion based upon the dog alert of Mr. Grock's car at some point in a 2 to 3 week time frame. And specifically found that, quote, officers knew that a narcotics-detecting canine had alerted to the presence of contraband in Grog's vehicle. The court concludes that, and I've italicized this in our brief on page 9, that this fact by itself is significant, and assuming that the canine sweep is proper, justifies the stop in this case. So the issue before this court is a very narrow and, frankly, very simple one. Does the extension of the doctrine of totality of the circumstances, as announced by this court in Arvizu and Sokolow in the United States Supreme Court, apply when the factors to be considered are the hit, the alert, so to speak, of the drug dog on a car connected to an individual whom which has never been near that car, by all accounts, for 2 to 3 weeks? Our answer to that question is that clearly the answer is no. That is not enough reasonable suspicion in order to justify the Terry detention of Grog outside of the airport on that date.
He did give consent to the search of the car, didn't he?
That, yes, Judge, he did, and it was after...
Bingo.
Well, Judge, he did give consent.
No, never mind. I was answering a question of my own mind. It had nothing to do with it.
Judge, and frankly, what happened from there, just so the court is clear, after consent was given, following what our argument is, was the illegal detention, and obviously the court is aware our argument is all of that, the consent and so forth, is fruit of the poisonous tree, but the consent was then given to the car. They found a suitcase within the car. He then consented again, according to the testimony of the suppression hearing, to search the suitcase. They found a firearm. Grog, being a felon, then admitted on the scene that the firearm belonged to him.
So everything swings on whether or not they had a right to do the Terry search at the beginning.
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly right. That is the issue and the only issue. This is a straightforward case. There's nothing complex about this. It's a totality of the circumstances analysis. And if this court finds that that was an unreasonable search with respect to the lack of circumstances, then the argument under Wong Sun is that it all should be suppressible because it's all fruit of the poisonous tree. If this court finds that there was reason to stop Grog in a Terry capacity, then obviously our argument fails.
You're into your rebuttal now.
I noticed that, Judge, and I'd like to reserve the rest of that time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McCloskey.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. I actually agree with counsel that this does narrow down to a very specific issue, whether or not Mr. Grog's investigatory stop was supported by reasonable suspicion. We obviously disagree, however, on whether or not the dog sniff, the positive dog sniff, supports reasonable suspicion. We argue that it does. There was information that the government received that Mr. Grog might be involved in some illegal activity. The police at some time, it is unclear, the record's unclear, at some time in the 2 to 3 week period before he came back from his trip, did conduct a sweep of the car. The dog positively alerted to something, and that's enough. That's enough under virtually all the case law I've seen from this court, from the Supreme Court. That's enough to support probable cause, certainly
dog
reasonable suspicion.
Out to be wrong, right?
Sorry, Judge?
The dog turned out to be wrong?
Well, based on what we know in the record, if it was in fact a narcotics or currency detection dog, then I suppose We could say that it was wrong and that we found a gun. We don't know, however, whether the government at that point went and looked even further to see if there was residue of narcotics. We don't know. It could have been a false alert.
Does the record say anything as to whether the car was kept under periodic surveillance after the dog sniffing until the incident we're talking about today?
I don't think so, Judge Ripple, but I will add that Mr. Grog led the agents to the car. He was able to take them right to the spot where he parked it 2 to 3 weeks earlier. There's no indication that there was some sort of an intervening factor that somebody else took the car away. He had the key. He let them into the car. And, of course, it was all according to the consent that Judge Bauer was asking about before. So if that was an issue that wasn't ventilated at all in the motion to suppress or at the hearing, and I would say that in this case, you know, that's simply not a factor. It was a positive dog alert. It could have been wrong. It's true. But it was certainly enough to support reasonable suspicion on the part of government agents to, at the very least, stop Mr. Grog when he comes back and ask him a few questions, which is exactly what they did here. He was very cooperative. The record shows that he was very cooperative. The district judge found that. Of course, this was all part of the consent analysis. It was voluntary consent every step of the way to search his person, to search the bags he was carrying. And ultimately, when they asked him if he had a car at the airport parking lot, he admitted he did, and he took them right to it. I have nothing to hide. He even said that a couple of times. And the government agents asked him when they got to the car, can we search the car? Yes. Can we search what's in the car, the suitcase? Yes. And lo and behold, there was a pistol. The dog may have been wrong. It's true, Judge, but I think the positive alert alone was enough to sustain reasonable suspicion on the part of the government to go down the road and to connect the dots as they did when Mr. Grogg came back.
You concur that the Terry stop began when the officers indicated to the couple who were going to give him a ride that they should move on?
In the district court, the government argued that was all, a completely consensual encounter. Mm-hmm. I think that the finding that the judge made is perfectly appropriate. That was a seizure from that point on. I don't think it changes the analysis. I think that they had reasonable suspicion to stop him to begin with. And everything that happened after that, certainly due, if nothing else, to his voluntary consent, that supported all of the events leading up to the discovery of the weapon. And of course, we would argue that his conviction was proper on that basis.
I want to back up just a little bit because I still want to understand. What is this someone that the ICE officers had their eye on before he went to France, or what was their reason for suspecting him in the first place?
Judge Mannion, the record's a little sparse on that, as counsel indicated. It appears that government agents, maybe the BATF, I think it was the BATF, received a call from a concerned citizen that Mr. Grogg might have weapons, he might have other paraphernalia, whatever that means, he might have child pornography. And so that's what started the ball rolling. It's unclear to me, and I'm not sure it's reflected in the record, what got ICE involved in particular as opposed to the BATF or some other agency. And I'm not sure if they had him under surveillance beforehand.
Well, to the extent they knew he was in France, they knew he delayed his ticket, that somehow they knew his car was parked there in the temporary or the short-term lot for a long period of time, and that and they knew that he was on the plane. Somebody's watching him. And I'm just... This is sort of an intriguing case for what seems to be not very much, other than the fact that he did find a weapon, which was by some informant. I don't, a lot of things just don't connect, that's all, and maybe the record doesn't connect them.
I don't think the record really does give a good indication, Judge.
So this is a lot of luck. And you go out in the airport. Unless there's a routine reporting of cars that are overstaying that's why I wonder about suspect of some weapons or something in it, because of the fact that this is somebody that's accruing a lot of money, $500, when he could have parked somewhere else or taken a cab.
Well,
is that alert airport people just when they see a car like that to check it?
The record doesn't reflect that, Judge, but I will say that whatever information the government agents did get from the concerned citizen at least was good enough to let them identify who Mr. Grogg was, because then they could check his travel plans, obviously. It's unclear, as counsel indicated, whether that was enough information to identify the car or whether they were able to identify Mr. Grogg through the car. But there is, again, no indication whether the car itself was spotted by airport security or something like that. This was a case where the government, for whatever reason, they were able to find his car, and that was, and then they brought a dog by, which alerted to it, obviously, and that was enough. That was enough for them to say, hey, we want to talk to this guy when he gets back. And that's exactly what they did, and there was nothing unconstitutional, nothing improper about that. If the court has no further questions, I'd be inclined to rest on the brief and ask again that the court affirm the conviction of Mr. Grogg.
Thank you, counsel. How much time does Mr. Gard have? 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Your Honor, as you noted, there was a 2 to 3 week time period where there is absolutely no testimony that this car was under any kind of surveillance whatsoever. That time period is crucial in this factual scenario when analyzing the totality of the circumstances. And to the extent then we have questions about why it's crucial. I would submit that all you have to do is think about staleness and how that doctrine applies to probable cause affidavits to search warrants. The simple fact is, three-week-old information is probably not going to be sufficient for a neutral and detached magistrate to sign off on a search warrant. And the reason for that is obvious. Things change. Facts change. People move. Items move. You can't sign off on material that is stale. In this scenario, although it's not directly applicable, the concept of staleness creates a temporal problem with the proximity between the dog alert and the detention of Mr. Grogg. The record here, as the court has noted, is somewhat sparse. And I would remind the court, the Fourth Amendment and its prohibition against unreasonable search and seizures has been interpreted to try and ask for a warrant preference. And what we have here is a warrant exception. It's the government's burden to demonstrate that exception. And to the degree that the record is sparse, that record should be construed against the government. The rule of leniency applies to benefit Mr. Grogg.
Well, if he'd refused his consent or whatever when they encountered him, then that's probably what they would have done, right?
I'm sorry, Judge.
If he had refused to let them search the car, then I guess they'd have to go on forward.
And Judge, that brings me to my other point, and that is, had Grogg simply not consented at that time, the officers would have been forced with a situation that could have been rectified much more easily. They had 2 to 3 weeks to go and get a search warrant. They had time to do it under the federal rules telephonically. They could have done it the old-fashioned way. They could have executed a search warrant, maybe if one was issued, and then had an arrest warrant waiting on Mr. Grogg as he disembarked. They chose to force the exigency in this matter. They chose to put Mr. Grogg in a situation where, as he's attempting to divest himself from his car, he is basically not able to avail himself of the defense. If they would have arrested him back at the hotel that evening, his defense may have been, I realized when I was in France that I had a gun in that car, and I didn't want to exert any dominion and control over that item. I was trying to do that, but I was detained too soon. And the fact that they forced the exigency in this situation is what distinguishes the validity of a drug dog alert in this scenario, as opposed to the typical drug dog alert on the side of the road where a car is inherently mobile and the automobile exception may apply. That's what distinguishes Grogg's facts from your typical drug dog alert. So as a result, as this court is aware, our contention is that he was stopped without reasonable suspicion and that his consent was invalid, and all of the rest of that material is fruit of the poisonous tree. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Garg. Mr. Garg, you and your colleagues served as appointed counsel in this case, and you have the deep thanks of the court for the fine job that you've done on behalf of your client. Our thanks also to counsel for the United States, and the case will be taken under advisement.